Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week, we visit with veterans, and the mission is pretty obvious. We don't want these stories to be forgotten. We want our veterans to be honored for their service and their sacrifice, their stories to be preserved. And for the rest of us, maybe we learn something about what it means to truly love your country. We're going to get a lesson in that today as we talk about the forgotten war. What war needs to be remembered more than one that is deemed the forgotten war? That is the Korean War. In the middle of its 60th anniversary from 1950 to 1953. So here we are, 60 years after 1951, talking about the Korean War. We're going to talk with a former prisoner of war, a Purple Heart recipient, David Mills of Scottsdale, Arizona. But that's not where you grew up. When I talk to World War II veterans, I ask them about Pearl Harbor Day. You were pretty young on Pearl Harbor Day. What were you, about 5 years old?
Yes, I think I was 6 years old. And I was born in Chester, Pennsylvania, and grew up for the first 12 years of my life in Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania, which is about 20 miles south of Philadelphia. On Pearl Harbor Day, I have very few recollections of that, other than seeing a newspaper indicating that the United States was at war.
And the Korean War didn't have that Pearl Harbor moment. It was a much different scenario and remains often misunderstood today. Some people don't know that the Korean War never officially ended, that there still is a demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. That zone may have never existed if not for the efforts of you and your fellow soldiers serving over there during the 1950s. When did it become clear to you that you were going to end up in the Army and that you would be part of something brewing overseas?
Well, I joined the Army on my 17th birthday on October the 6th, 1952. And I did not have any idea that I would end up in Korea, other than I joined the Army to have an opportunity to visit other parts of the world, not knowing at that time that by law, one had to be 18 and a half years of age to be sent outside of the United States. However, in my particular case, and in several others of which I'm aware, that particular part of the law must have either been overlooked or not completely understood, because we happened to end up outside of the United States.
Yeah, in a place that you've never been able to forget since those harrowing days 60 years ago. David Mills of Scottsdale, Arizona, our guest today. He is a Purple Heart recipient and involved with the American ex-prisoners of war. We're going to find out how he became a prisoner of war, and you're going to hear us talk about something called Outpost Harry. And before we go any further, I want to let you know about a film called Hold at All Costs. You may have heard me mention it on this program before. You may have caught it on a PBS station over Memorial Day weekend. If it didn't air on the PBS station in your neighborhood, I hope you'll contact that station and ask them to show you Hold at All Costs. All the information is on our website at kmjnow.com. David let me watch a version of it that he has at home. He's featured as one of the veterans speaking in that excellent documentary that really gives you a feel for Outpost Harry. But before we get to Outpost Harry, why don't you describe what it was like for you to arrive in Korea, what you understood about what you were doing there as a 17-year-old kid who'd probably rather be playing basketball?
Well, we left the United States around the middle of March 1953 and spent 14 days on a ship called the Marine Lynx, which took us to Yokohama Harbor in Japan, where we spent 3 days in Camp Drake, Japan, being outfitted and getting our equipment for being sent on to Korea. It took us another several days to get from Japan to Korea, and we entered through Incheon Harbor, where I was assigned to F Company, Fox Company, of the 15th Infantry Regiment, of the 3rd Infantry Division, and immediately sent to Outpost Harry, which was a company-sized outpost, approximately 500 yards in front of the American main line of resistance in no man's land. It was fronted by a Chinese outpost called Star, which was about 500 yards north of Outpost Harry, and another Chinese outpost directly behind Star called North Star.
And that film that I mentioned, Hold at All Costs, does an excellent job of painting both the minute details and the overall picture of what was happening at this point in world history. But I'm curious for you, did you have any idea what you were getting into and how significant Outpost Harry was going to become in your life?
Not at all. I knew we were in a war. It had been going on for over 2 years. And being sent to an infantry company on the main lines, it was obvious that we would be perhaps engaged in some fighting. But I don't think any of us, at least the enlisted men, of which I was one, had any idea about what was about to happen on Outpost Harry and the significance of it leading towards, actually, we believe, the finalization of the war in the summer of 1953.
And the film certainly breaks that case down and presents a strong background for that. What was your first taste of enemy action there on Outpost Harry, which I'm sure became very clear to you pretty quickly that this was a crucial place for the American and Allied forces to hold at that point, that you could not be giving up that ground or else a big Chinese advance into South Korea would have happened?
The Chinese used what we Americans termed as harassing fire, in which every day they would fire artillery rounds into our hill. Also, snipers were used. They had very excellent snipers. And they would try to pick us off as we move through the trenches each day. So there was constant bombardment, not in the form of the kind of artillery bombardment that precedes an all-out attack, but constant bombardment in that it could be at random or it could be quite inclusive, in which every single day you were pounded by artillery. You had to keep yourself undercover at all times and be aware that you could be shot at any time.
This sounds like an awful way to live and something that's going to take a little adjusting to, especially as a 17-year-old kid. How did you deal with that? How did you get used to the fact that you couldn't move without being shot at, basically, or that at any point you could be hit?
Well, maybe at 17 that was an advantage in that regard, because at a young age, and I think the service likes young men and women at young ages, because we will do whatever we're told very often without thinking, because at that age we're not mature enough, quite frankly, to do an awful lot of in-depth concentration about what is actually happening. And you've been trained very well, and the Army can train its recruits very well and to mold you into a very effective fighting person. And so it really didn't bother me that much, because after a while, you could certainly tell the difference between incoming shells from the Chinese and outgoing shells from the American artillery, and you knew when to duck and when not to duck. And the old cliche of you don't hear the one that gets you is certainly true, because the missiles fire faster and travel faster than the speed of sound. So if you've heard the sound, the missile's already by you and you've survived.
You obviously are serving with a lot of guys that you've just gotten to know. You're probably forming a few bonds here and there. And we're going to hear eventually about when you were hit, how many times you were hit, what it did to you. But I imagine that you probably saw some of your buddies get hit before you did. And what was that like for you? Did that alter your thinking about it? Did you get to the point where you thought, you know, I might be next. I might not survive this. I might not be going home and hanging out with my brothers anymore.
Strangely enough, most of us never thought it would happen to us. It would always happen to someone else. And that's, I don't know if that's some kind of a psychological safety valve that allows you to function under the most extraordinary circumstances, such as constantly in fear for your life. But I can tell you that a gentleman who was wounded in the face on the evening that I was captured was marched past me at the beginning of what I would call the Chinese artillery zeroing in process. He'd been wounded in the face by shrapnel, and often face and head wounds looked a lot worse than they were because the blood vessels are very long. There's not a lot of tissue under the skin, and so they bleed profusely. And he had a towel wrapped around his head, and they marched him right on by, and he was walking okay. Obviously, he needed attention, but you look at it and you feel bad for him, but you go on. You don't think an awful lot about it, or you wouldn't be able to function well enough yourself when the time came and the need arose.
And your position in your company was one of a rifleman, but when things get hairy, not outpost hairy, but H-A-I-R-Y, when everything's firing here and there, you kind of have to improvise. And on the day that you were wounded, I understand that's exactly what you did.
Yes, that's correct. I was assigned as a rifleman with an M1 rifle in Fox Company. And the gentleman whom I just described being marched past me had been a Browning automatic rifleman on the top perimeter of the hill. I was initially posted on the access egress trench that would take us back to our main lines. He had been wounded, and a sergeant came by looking for a replacement. And he looked at what must have looked to him as the dumbest looking fellow there. And he said, "Hey, you go up there and take his BAR and take his place." And I looked behind me to see who he was pointing to, and there was no one behind me. And so obviously he meant me. And naturally I said, "Okay, Sarge." And I went up to the top of the hill. Now, unfortunately, when the gentleman who'd been wounded marched down the hill, he took his 45 with him. Usually a Browning automatic rifleman or any automatic weapons individual has a sidearm to protect himself with should something happen to his weapon, because when you're shooting that rapidly, it could jam, it could overheat, and it draws an awful lot of attention from the enemy, and they will give you undue attention very quickly. So you need to have as many weapons as you possibly can. And now I was without a sidearm.
And did that occur to you at the time that you were going to put yourself in further harm's way by taking over that position?
Not at all. I was doing what I was ordered. And we are so well trained in the Army, and we were told so many times during basic training that it probably didn't sink in with any significance at the time, but you must obey immediately. It can save your life. Obey immediately. Do not hesitate. It can save your life. And so we were conditioned to do that.
And what did you find? What did you see? What did you experience once you got to that position?
Well, I arrived at the top of the perimeter in about 5 minutes, and I was the only person in a fighting bunker. There was another Browning automatic rifleman, perhaps 10 yards, 30 feet north of me to my left, and we would naturally shoot across one another's field of fire in order to establish a wider field of fire and cover the entire terrain of the area on the side of the hill where we were posted. This was just something that we were supposed to do. And I was very comfortable in my position. It was on the eastern side of Outpost Harry. The attacks usually came from the north. However, being so far out into no man's land, the Chinese always surrounded the hill and tried to attack on all sides. And every single time we were attacked, they gained the trenches, and we ended up fighting hand-to-hand eventually.
So you had been through battles like this before that day?
No, I hadn't been through a battle like was going to happen. I had been through skirmishes before and had been through artillery barrages, but nothing that prepared us for what was going to occur that night. The kind of a battle that occurred that night was the kind that you remember forever.
And clearly David Mills does remember it forever. We're going to hear more of that story, hear what else happened that night, what happened in the months that followed, why it means so much to him today, and some of the recent events that have brought it full circle for this Korean War veteran, a Purple Heart recipient, and a prisoner of war. David Mills of Scottsdale, Arizona, our guest. We'll be back with more of his story next. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We focus today on the forgotten war and a man who experienced some of the most intense moments of the Korean War, some crucial moments to what eventually happened there, to the reason that South Korea exists as a free country today. David Mills, 75 years old, of Scottsdale, Arizona, our guest. And when we left off, we were talking about April 24th, 1953, when he is a 17-year-old rifleman in an army company atop Outpost Harry. Ended up alone on a Browning automatic rifle, not knowing where the enemy was coming from, not knowing what was going to happen. And I suppose other than the light of gunfire and artillery, it was a dark night. Everything got crazy at about 10:30 at night. Is that right?
That is correct. The Chinese had been zeroing in for some time, perhaps an hour and a half. But with harassing fire every night, it was no different than any other night. And we certainly didn't know or expect the very heavy artillery barrage that began at about 10:30 at night. I really don't know how to explain to anyone what it is like. No words can describe adequately what it is like. The noise, the dirt, the dust, all of the confusion, the anguish. It's just a constant, continuous roar. There is no let up. There's just explosion. It's like one large mass explosion that has no higher or lower range to it. There is no frequency. It is constant, and it is absolutely unreal. During the time of the barrage, the American artillery is shooting up flares to illuminate the area for us and so that we can see them when they come. However, when their artillery barrage stopped, then we could hear them blow whistles in which they control movements of their troops by signaling them with very sharp sounding whistles. We were attacked at all sides. We were completely overrun. There was hand-to-hand fighting in the trenches. I heard the 50 caliber machine gun stop firing. I heard the heavy 30 caliber machine gun stop firing. I heard the light 30 caliber machine gun stop firing. And then the BARs are next, because the enemy would always try and eradicate the automatic weapons because of the damage they can do so quickly to so many of their troops. The American positions had superior firepower at all times, which is one of the reasons the Chinese were not attacked in the daytime. They would only attack at night and try to infiltrate or get as close to our positions as possible under the cover of darkness. When they completely got into our trenches, the American artillery observer called in for the American artillery right down on top of our positions.
Which is somewhat of a desperate move that puts all of you in further danger, right?
It is a very desperate move. It is the last attempt to hold a position because the order had come down from 8th Army headquarters that we had to hold at all costs, which meant we had to stay there and die if necessary to hold that hill, because strategically it was so important in an elevated natural position that should the Chinese gain control of it, the American lines would have had to have been pulled back a very long distance in order to get it the next secure defensive posture, possibly losing Seoul, the capital of South Korea, again during the process, which would have been very much unacceptable to American authorities. It would have extended the life of the war, many thousands on both sides. More would have died, not to say the countless number of civilians who would also have died.
And you came very close to dying that night on April 24th of 1953. Before we get the rest of that story and your wounding and your capture, when you talk about the order to hold at all costs, and you explain what it meant. What did it mean to you at the time? And how did that hit you as a teenager with, you were hoping, a whole life in front of you?
I wasn't even thinking about my life in front of me, and I wasn't even thinking about the potential consequences of it. In the heat of the battle, you're acting and reacting. You've been trained, and you're acting out of rote, practically. You don't stop and think logically about what you're doing. You do what you think is necessary to survive, and that's what it basically gets down to. We thought the Chinese artillery barrage was fierce and heavy until the American artillery came down on top of us, and then it was absolutely calamitous. I cannot explain how it was, how it sounded. It is something that you would have to experience in order to understand it. And I hope no one in this country ever has to experience that on our native soil.
So are you saying that the order to hold at all costs had no real effect on you? Or do I maybe sense that, if anything, it only motivated you more, or summoned some kind of righteous nobility, a desire to serve your country with the highest degree of courage that you could?
It had really no effect on us because we never thought of retreat. That thought never entered our mind. We were Americans. Not that we were unbeatable, but we just never thought about it because we thought that we would prevail. We thought that we would win. And in the middle of the battle, you do not have time to think about philosophical or ideological aspects of the conflict you're in. It becomes a matter of survival.
And how did you survive? When were you hit? What did it feel like? What was that experience like? And how did you get through it?
Well, I survived by the grace of God. I was in a fighting bunker by myself. As I previously stated, all other automatic weapons had been knocked out. I was the only American that I knew of at that time still fighting on Outpost Harry.
And this was with an initial strength of about, what, 88 men?
Yes. There were 88 men on the hill that night. I found out afterwards. I did not know at the time how many were there, but the battle had gotten down to a very few, and I was completely surrounded. And so it didn't matter in which direction I fired. I was not going to hit any friendlies. I was going to hit enemies. And so I saw a movement just in a corner of my eye in a trench behind my bunker. I just glanced backward for some reason and saw a small fellow drop a grenade in the trench just to my backside. And I turned left, and a hand grenade went off. And then I knew that they were in the trench right behind me. So I turned in that direction and with my BAR, put a new magazine into it, went to cock the operating rod, which has to be moved backward one time to fire it automatically. And I couldn't get it back. It was so hot, I couldn't move it. So I had to put the butt of the BAR on the ground, take the heel of my boot, and jam it down. And while I'm doing this, I'm standing out in the trench, and another hand grenade was thrown by a Chinese soldier maybe 10 yards away from me, and it went off between my legs. Now, at this time, I pulled the BAR up, and I'm looking through the smoke and the dust, and I see the muzzle flash of a Chinese submachine gun, which we nicknamed the burp gun. It was actually a Russian submachine gun used by the Chinese. And I saw a group of Chinese soldiers there, and I killed them all.
And I know this is not easy to talk about when you think back, and I can see in your face the toll that it takes on you even today. And I'm assuming that that's purely instinct, survival instinct and reaction.
Yes, it is. The trench was no more than 4 feet wide, and he missed. Now, how he missed me, I don't know. But he did. By the grace of God, I wasn't killed. But I didn't miss. My weapon was no longer operable. And so I headed out the other direction of the trench towards the bunker where the adjoining BIR man was supposed to be. I was without a weapon now, and so I was seeking one. and another grenade was thrown in near me, which knocked me down. I got up and crawled over the top of the trench, which was about 6 feet high, and was lying on my stomach with my head inside the aperture of the bunker next to me. And there was a rifle leaning up against the wall. There was nobody in there. And I reached in and had the barrel of the rifle in the palm of my hand, and I started to back out when I felt something poking into my back. And I didn't think it was a friendly. I had seen or heard no other American weapons. And when you're there, you can tell the sound of a weapon very well. I can still today, if I hear any weapon fire at all, I can tell you exactly what the caliber is. And so I turned over very slowly. I'm lying on my back now, and I'm looking up into the barrel of a Chinese or Russian submachine gun about 3 inches from my nose. And a little fellow standing over me with it, looking down at me, and two of his fellow soldiers, Chinese soldiers, standing next to them. Now, they did not have guns. They were grenade carriers, and they had vests on with three grenades on each side of their chest, a total of six, in their vest. And their grenades looked like potato masher-shaped grenades with a long handle, either made of bamboo or wood, with a cast-iron cylinder. And so I'm lying on the ground looking up this barrel, and I'm thinking, if I could get that barrel away from this guy, I could kill them all. And then I thought, well, this guy's got his finger on the trigger, and any movement on my part, he's going to blow my brains out. And I really thought I was going to die. And so having the good fortune of being brought up in a Christian spiritual home, I knew what to do, and that was to pray. So I prayed the prayer of a sinner, and in my mind I said, "Oh God, have mercy on my soul." And a peace came over me that I have never felt before nor since. I was prepared to die and meet my Maker. And at that moment, the next thought I had was, I wonder how my parents are going to take this. I looked around, and maybe 10 seconds had gone by, and they hadn't done anything more to me, and so I thought, maybe I can survive. And then I got scared. I didn't even know I was wounded. I had been wounded 9 times, but I hadn't felt a thing up until that time. And it turned out that I had been wounded twice in the head. I had 2 holes in my steel helmet, and 6 times in the legs, and once in the left arm. They took me over off the hill, and I saw nobody alive. Every single bunker except 2. The other BAR man's and mine were crashed down. I saw dead everywhere. Americans, Chinese, all over the place. One of our officers was once asked, "Why do you let these guys overrun you with your superior firepower?" And his answer simply was, "We just can't shoot them fast enough. There are so many of them, they just completely overwhelm us." And that is true. They took me off the hill, and at the top of the front of the hill where they had initially had their first assault, they took the gentleman who had the submachine gun, took the butt of it and hit me between the shoulder blades in the back and knocked me down the hill. And I laid at the bottom of the hill, Outpost Harry, and I thought, if I move, they'll probably shoot me. They could shoot me anyhow. But I laid there until they got down, and they hoisted me up, and we walked off. And it wasn't too long before my legs started acting funny, that they weren't working the way that they should be. And each rise, we went up several rises, and down at the top of each rise, they decided that I needed to get down the hill the same way they'd done the first time, and they would hit me between the shoulder blades with the butt of the weapon and knock me down the hill. And each time I thought, that'll be the end. But I was prepared to go because I was praying the whole time. Eventually, they took me to a cave and placed me next to a Chinese soldier who had been brought in there. He had 3 bullet holes in his stomach. And I laid down next to him and went to sleep. And he died during the night. And I saw them when they brought me in, pointing to me and pointing to him and pointing to me and pointing to him. And I thought at the time maybe he was one of those that I had shot. I have no way of knowing, and I don't know if that's what they meant. It was the only thing I could think of at the time. And even though I was in those very unfortunate circumstances for me, the need for rest overwhelmed. And at 17 years old, I laid down and went to sleep.
Wow, if you're listening to this, I'm sure it's moving you like it's moving me, that you can hear the crystal clear nature of the memories. You can probably imagine what that pain felt like and wonder how David Mills would get through this ordeal. And we're going to answer that question when we come back. The rest of Hometown Heroes coming right up here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we continue to hear from David Mills about his incredible experience during the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War. It was happening 60 years ago, halfway across the world. And I want you to go to our website, kmjnow.com, see the information I have there, not just about Mr. Mills, but also about the film Hold at All Costs. And I encourage you to watch that. I was able to watch that with David in his home and was incredibly moved by the courage that is captured in that documentary. You're hearing it firsthand from David Mills himself, and we'll continue his story now. When we left off, he had been captured by Chinese forces. He was ready to die. You heard him talk about the prayer he prayed that brought peace to his heart and soul. And you said you were prepared to go. And I bet a day didn't go by that you thought you might go.
There was the continuous possibility that each day might be your last. Some amazing things happened. After falling asleep, the next morning, I woke up and was told to come out of the cave, and I crawled out of the cave. And a soldier appeared, and I was ordered to start marching down the road. And I got up and tried to walk, and I could not walk. And so they came up and motioned with a gun and pushed me with the barrel and said I should begin walking, and I could not walk. So they motioned for me to sit down on a rock. And I thought, well, this will be it. And maybe 5 minutes went by, and four little fellows came around the corner with a stretcher. And they put me on a stretcher. Now, I'm an American soldier. I was in a battle the night before with their soldiers and killed some of them. They put me on a stretcher, and they began to carry me. And they carried me for 7 to 10 days. I'm not sure now. My recollection is not clear on exactly how many days they carried me to a collection center. But the first evening that we stopped, I received the very first interrogation of my captivity. And the interrogator and I were in a room alone. And he sat with a pistol on his lap, and he would not let me go to the bathroom. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever had urinary retention, but eventually it feels like somebody's sticking a knife right up your groin. And eventually you cannot urinate, no matter how badly you want to. And so he's sitting there, and I remember the first three questions of the first interrogation only. And the first question was, are there any Japanese troops in your lines? The second question was, why do you Americans fight so fiercely when you're cornered? And the third question was, are you a Christian? Now, this man sat there interrogating me, speaking English grammatically better than I did. And I didn't think of it at the time that perhaps he had been educated in a missionary school and perhaps was a Christian himself, serving his country in the army as I was serving my country in the army. I looked at him and I thought to myself of the scripture verse when Jesus said, you confess me before man, I'll confess you before the Father. You deny me before man, and I will deny you before the Father. And so I said, yes, I am a Christian. Those Chinese soldiers carried me for the next 7 to 10 days. They protected me from the North Korean civilian population, which tried to get at me several times to do me harm with farm tools. Until we reached the collection center, where at the time I was the only American prisoner. Eventually, enough American prisoners arrived until there was a truckload, and towards the end of the war, they took us north to prison camps in trucks rather than making us march. While I was at this collection center, I was put into a dungeon, which only one person, size for one person, and it was made for a much smaller person. I was 6 feet tall. When I was captured, I weighed 175 pounds. For the first 2 weeks, I could not eat any of their food. It was about 18 inches below ground level. When it rained, the water ran in, and I laid in the water. There were lice. I spent a lot of my daily time picking lice out of my clothing and my skin. The room was too small for me to stretch out completely, and it wasn't high enough for me to sit up completely, so I was in sort of a semi-crouch, almost a prenatal position, almost all of the time without being able to stretch out. And as I said, I couldn't eat the food. After 2 weeks and losing a lot of weight quickly, I decided I was going to have to eat or else I was going to die. And so that's the way I existed. A few more prisoners, American prisoners, were brought there, and perhaps 2 or 3 weeks later, we were taken north to a place called a mining camp, Camp 6, near Suwon, for the remainder of my time in the prison camp. I was a prisoner of war for 4 months to the day, and I spent 2 of those months in solitary confinement. I was accused by the Chinese of several offenses for which they told me I was going to have a trial. Fortunately, I did not have any trials, and why they didn't, I don't know. They could have. They could do anything they wanted to do because we were completely helpless, and I think that that was perhaps the most distressing of all aspects of our situation, complete helplessness. You have no control over what you do when you get up, when you go to bed, when you go to bed. That's kind of a fictitious term for a prisoner of war, since our accommodation that I lived in was about a 10 by 12 foot hut in which 5 prisoners were there. 2 Englishmen, Bill Clark and Dennis Campbell, 1 Australian, whose only first name I know is Fred, and 2 Americans, a guy by the name of Thompson from Minnesota, and myself. And we slept head to toe. It was our living room, our dining room, our bedroom, our everything. We were fortunate to have one another. I would like to express the greatest act of courage that I ever saw in my life exhibited while I was in this camp. Our camp valley that we were in ran east and west, and the topography was so severe there was no need for barbed wire or any other kind of artificial enclosure. The formation of the mountains were sufficient. Our prisoner of war huts were towards the west end of the valley. And in the middle of the valley was Chinese barracks and headquarters. And at the east end of the valley was a mine. One morning around 8 a.m., I was across a creek which ran right through the middle of the valley on the other side from the huts, an area that we could go over and walk in occasionally. And I was over there walking. And the sun was high at 8 o'clock in the morning, and an American jet came out of the sun, and of course we didn't hear it. And I'm walking with my back to the sun, and all of a sudden I see the ground jumping up around me, and I knew that that was not supposed to happen. And so I got out of there as quickly as I could. You're supposed to lie down, not move. I wasn't self-controlled enough for that, as I moved as quickly as I could, even though it was slowly, towards a bank and buried my face in the bank. And on the first pass, the American jet came through strafing, and obviously he was judging the distance about how far he could dive in before he had to pull out without running into the mountains at the west end of the valley. And he came around for his second pass, and we only knew he'd gone by after the bullets tore the ground up. Then we heard this whoom as he went by, and he came up around for his second pass, and he dropped, I believe, a 500-pound bomb. And had a direct hit on the Chinese barracks, blew it up and killed an awful lot of Chinese soldiers. During this attack, an English soldier who was our camp barber sat alongside of an Australian soldier who was shot directly through the leg. When the bone of his leg was severed and could not get away from the buildings, and sat next to him and read the scriptures out of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. There were bullet holes from the strafing, no more than 2 or 3 feet from them as a result of the passes that were made. And this man was offering himself as a sacrifice, if necessary, to comfort his fellow soldier during a time of difficulty. These are the kind of actions that are common to the battlefield and do happen occasionally in civilian life, but so rarely that they're looked upon with some great deal of appreciation. I was repatriated on August 24th, 1953, through Panmunjom. Immediately upon reaching Freedom Village, we were given a physical examination shortly thereafter and an opportunity to meet a chaplain, which I took advantage of, and put on a helicopter. 30 minutes later, we were in Incheon, where we received another physical examination. The following day, we were placed on a Navy ship on our way home, and in 10 days, we were in San Francisco. After arriving in San Francisco, 5 hours later, I was on a plane flying from San Francisco to Buffalo, New York, where my family was waiting for me at the airport.
And I'm sure that was an unbelievable day. Your family had received telegrams saying that you were missing. They were praying that you were a prisoner of war and not added to the list of killed in action. I understand since then you've even seen a yearbook of your division that lists you among the killed in action. What was that reunion like with your family?
Well, being a 17-year-old, I had decided I was going to surprise them. That I knew that the military would tell them that I was released, and I had sent them a telegram from the ship myself telling them that I was okay and would be coming home. But I didn't tell them what flight I would be on, and I thought I would rent a car or a taxi cab from Buffalo and walk in the door and say, "Mom, I'm home." And that's the kind of silly thing that a 17-year-old thinks about, but the military had notified my parents of the flight that I would be on, and I saw my dad and my mother and my youngest brother are waiting for me on the tarmac at the airport, and I got off the plane and got over to them just as fast as I could. And I'm sure heaven's going to be greater than all of that. But that was heaven on earth to me at that time. We got in the car. I sat up front with Dad, and we started driving home, which was about 65 miles away. And we got to a little town called Canandaigua, 3 miles from our hometown of Houghton, New York. And there were 6 cars waiting for me, and a little motorcade and a pickup truck from the local grocer leading it with a big sign on it painted, "Welcome Home, Dave." We got in the motorcade, and we're traveling into our little small hometown of about 500 permanent residents in a 6-car motorcade, and it was a little 2-room schoolhouse on the edge of town. And all the children were out, the teachers had them out along the fence waving little American flags. And I got up, and we stopped, and I didn't know what to do. My father said, "Get out." And I never questioned my dad. And so, even though I was coming home, I hadn't been a soldier in the service, I got out of the car and waved to them, and they all cheered. It was just a wonderful moment of small town America that no one could have planned. It just happened. And then we went up to our home, and some officials from the community were there waiting for us, and were very hospitable. I was asked if I would attend a town meeting that night. The town is so small, it has no traffic lights, and the state police ride through once a week. But that evening, we had 2 state police patrol cars directing traffic. There were so many people. And I was welcomed home officially by the community at a town reception that evening, a memory of which I will always cherish the rest of my life.
And you've received similar kinds of attention the last couple of years. Just last month, you're in Washington, D.C. at the GI Film Festival, where Hold at All Costs was honored. You've been able to represent men and women of your generation and Korean War veterans at a lot of different functions, as you represent prisoners of war as well. But as we run short on time here, when you think about that forgotten war, when you think about the many more American lives that were lost on Outpost Harry while you were in captivity, eventually succeeding in holding that hill at all costs, what is the thing that you want people to remember about the Korean War in general, about Outpost Harry in specifics, and about what you and all those guys did 60 years ago?
The film, Hold at All Costs, is dedicated to all those men who perished on Outpost Harry to, in effect, serve to end the Korean War sooner than it would have ended had it fallen, and save an awful lot of lives on both sides and a lot of Korean civilians. Unknown to us at the time, but looking back now from a 60-year perspective, the stalemate that occurred afterwards at Korea, well, at the time thought to be a loss, turned out to be a turning point and the basis for winning the Cold War, because that was the first time that American forces had participated in an actual battle action stopping communism from being spread around the world. And no more was any country then taken over in that regard by the use of those means. Now, as far as what it means today that South Korea is a free people, that it's a democratic country, their economy is booming, they're very prosperous, they're free. And if you have an opportunity to look at a night image of the Korean Peninsula on the internet, you will see that above the 38th parallel north, it's completely dark. They can't even light their own country. They can't even produce enough food to feed themselves. They have even lost several inches in their height over the last 40 or 50 years because of malnutrition. By contrast, South Korea is booming, prosperous, the second largest economy in Southeast Asia after Japan, and it's lit up like a Christmas tree or perhaps Times Square on New York City.
And that is because of the sacrifices of all those men you served with. You nearly joined the ranks of those who paid the ultimate price for freedom there in Korea. I'm thankful you didn't. I want to thank you for serving our country, for everything that you're doing for other veterans and other prisoners of war now. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listening audience?
Well, we live in the greatest country on earth, the greatest country that's ever been on earth. And so I say to all of you, God bless all of you, and God bless America.
No better way to end the program than that. David Mills of Scottsdale, Arizona, has been our guest today. You can hear the entire interview anytime you want at kmjnow.com. And we'll be back with another edition of Hometown Heroes next week on News Talk 580 KMJ.